Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour. Very special sort of retro ep. This week we look at the film Speed. And I'm joined by two people that know infinitely more about the film than I do. I've seen the film. I know quite a lot about it. But one of them, Ron Brinkman, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
So, Ron, you actually worked on the film.
Yeah, I have fond memories of Speed. It was, I think, the first movie I was the CG supervisor on. And just going back quite a few years. And it was funny because it was, well, I'll get into the story in a bit, but yeah, it's a good movie for me.
And the other person that's joining us this week is Ian. Ian, how are you?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
Now, you're actually, well, vaguely interested in this film. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's probably my favorite action film ever. I saw it when I was 16 for the first time, just getting into films, and just still absolutely love it. Probably seen it hundreds of times.
Wow. Well, yeah.
Well, I was just saying before we started recording, I was tempted to go back and rewatch it to refresh my memory, but I decided not to, or I was too lazy to, one of the two. And so it'll be interesting to see what I remember and how well that fits with what the reality of it is.
I think that before we get into the visual effects, I think there are a couple of aspects of the filmmaking that that are worth commenting on. And I think I'd like to start actually with the villain of the piece, Dennis Hopper, because he recently passed away. And it's one of the reasons that we wanted to do this episode of the VFX show. I actually have an enormous, I mean, enormous amount of respect for Dennis Hopper. And it extends far beyond the kind of normal stuff that you get from Easy Rider. I think that he was not only a terrific actor and acted very well in many productions, but he had a terrific interest in fine art and supported the modern art movement extensively. Ron, you must have also enjoyed his performance in this film.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think in a lot of ways a movie like this would probably have been seen as a throwaway role for somebody like Dennis Hopper. You know, he's never been a superstar kind of an actor in terms of getting the real name brand roles, I guess, but you know, tremendous actor, and even in a movie like this, which you know, could easily be dismissed and probably was dismissed as just sort of a mindless action flick before it really got out there, he still brought a lot of just interesting character to this, and you know, really took that villain role to the next level.
I don't think that Dennis Hopper was necessarily the cinematic draw card that some other big actors of his generation became. But having said that, there are performances of his, obviously Apocalypse Now and Blue Velvet and others, that are just legendary. And I think you've got to look at the actor in terms of the quality of the work in this particular case rather than the box office pull. But I think that there are two things in this film that I think were great decisions. Dennis Hopper gave the film, I think, just a really interesting villain that was kind of witty, but by the same token, not slapstick and stupid. And I think the other really good decision, and I only discovered this thanks to our terrific research from Todd, our producer, and I just did not know this, but apparently, initially, the character that was played by Keanu Reeves was going to be a smartass making wisecracks a la Die Hard. And Josh Whedon was brought in late in the game for a rewrite on the script, and with Reeves' input, actually turned him from this kind of maverick smartass to a very polite guy, because Keanu Reeves had worked with actual police in lead up to a previous film role, and as a consequence, I think not playing him like a diehard Bruce Willis character was a great move. And so those two aspects, I think, really carried the film and gave it a lot more dimension from an acting point of view. What do you think, Ian?
Oh, definitely, definitely. With Keanu as well, it was a bit of a breakthrough role for him, don't you think? And if he'd taken it as a bit of a smart-ass actor, I don't think he would have been so successful afterwards. So, yeah, I think that worked really well.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because it really fits with Keanu's real-life persona. He's a really nice, almost shy kind of guy. I mean, I only met him a couple times, but yeah, he is a very polite, kind of quiet guy, and you know, almost to the level of, you know, sort of doesn't make eye contact a whole lot. So you can sort of see where a writer like Joss Whedon, who's got it going on, would probably just decide to go with that. And I think it really speaks to the best of Keanu Reeves' movies too, where he is cast in a role that he's for it. I mean, he's obviously not a really broad actor in terms of being able to do anything like, you know, some of our really great actors are, but when he's cast in the right role like this or in The Matrix, I think he's great. I love watching him.
I love the fact that at the end of The Matrix, I forget which film it is now, he literally bought all his stunt guys Harleys to just say thanks for taking them for him. And in fact, in this film, interestingly, he did a large proportion of his own stunts, which is really quite extraordinary because, you know, obviously you don't want to shut a film down for obviously you don't want to risk the life of a stuntman, but you obviously are more flexible with a professional stunt person than you are with an actor if there's a minor injury, because of course, you know, you can't film. I was surprised to hear that. I think that Keanu Reeves doesn't get some of the credit he's due. I mean, obviously there are some films that'll haunt him for the rest of his career, like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
but even that one is, he was well cast for it, right? And that's part of the problem, is that he's so well cast for a role like that that he becomes almost a caricature of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree. And the trouble is, yeah, he was very good as the dude, and he found, I think, that, you know, sort of hung around a little. But, you know, like, he has done a lot of good films. And, of course, The Matrix, the original Matrix, is, again, just one of the all-time great VFX films. It's stunning.
Totally.
Hey, let me ask you about the other third key role in this, a role that was passed up by, I'm going to list a few people here, Glenn Close, Kim Basinger, Deborah Winger, right through to Carrie Fisher, Jodie Foster, even Bridget Fonda and Julia Roberts, and that was the role that Sandra Bullock took. Now, I understand that even Ellen DeGeneres was initially thought of for this role because it was going to be a happy sidekick, but what do we think of her in this film?
It was kind of a breakout role for her too, right?
Yeah, definitely, Ron. I think, you know, she hadn't really done that many big films beforehand at all. And she just played it perfectly, I thought. You know, didn't really do damsel in distress, but also played the strong sidekick. And, and you know, when you're 16 years old, Sandra Bullock was amazing.
I was about to say, she wasn't 16 when she made this.
When you're watching it as a 16-year-old.
No, no, I've heard it now, yeah.
She was pretty amazing if you happen to be a little older than that and were watching it too.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think everybody fell in love with her on this, right? You know, I never met her. I saw her, you know, coming out of the sound recording booth, and Jan DeBont, the director, always kept, you know, calling her Sandy. Sandy this, Sandy that. But, watching the movie, you fell in love with her.
Let's talk about the director, because this is somebody that obviously has an incredibly strong cinematography background. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Ron?
Yeah, well, he was a DP before this, shooting on a lot of action films. And so clearly he knows how to stage an action scene. And, you know, he was sort of known for being a really gonzo kind of a DP, too. I can't remember what movie it was, but... there was some movie that they were shooting in Africa where I guess part of his scalp was peeled off by a lion because Jan wanted to get in and get the right shot. So, he clearly was into the moment and getting into this kind of stuff. And I think it shows in the movie. I mean, it's not a flashy movie in terms of cinematography, I don't think. But, you know, it tells the story in a very engaging fashion.
He was most significantly the DOP on Die Hard, which of course probably is one of the reasons why he was happy to go in a different direction with the lead character to not kind of go that same path. But he was director of photography on Hunt for Red October and Black Rain. And both of those films, I think, were really well shot. Black Rain had a film clip kind of feel to it that was very fresh in 89. And I loved that film. Of course, he also did a bunch of other films as a director. Most interestingly, he also did Twister, which is another really big effects film just after this. And I think that was a period where, you know, the effects were so breathtakingly we hadn't seen them before, Ron, that you used to just sort of like you almost couldn't view a film like Twister or in fact Speed without narrowing it on a visual effect or a style of visual effect. Whereas today, of course, you tend to have a complete, you know, collection of them.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Twister was sort of set the bar for atmospheric or weather or whatever you want to call it kind of effects, these natural effects that were more particle system driven kind of stuff. It had not really been done to that level before, you know, even close to it. It was, you know, you can point to these landmark films like Jurassic Park, where that's where they really finally nailed living creatures, and Twister was sort of the one where they finally nailed atmospheric kind of stuff.
And let's face it, they nailed manual tracking, because this was a film right before we had fully digital automated tracking, and a lot of that stuff was hand-tracked by the team in that film, and to stunning effect, because I remember looking at it and just couldn't believe that someone had managed to track that stuff in. We take it all for granted today. So,
well, I was going to say, just while we're on that topic, because that was one of the, and we can go into this in a little more detail if you want, but that was one of the interesting things about this, is there was a couple of scenes during that bus jump that were, you know, handheld that turned into tracking shots, and it was really, I mean, I remember when we were discussing those shots, and it was just like, oh God, how do we do that?
Oh, we will discuss those in 1 second. I was just going to ask Ian really quickly. Ian, can you tell us how many shots Ron did on this film?
No.
I don't think I can tell you that. So,
did anyone have any feel for the shot count?
It was small.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. We'll get into the visual effects, of course, won't we? But the best thing that I like about the effects in this film is that it's a mix between practical CG and miniatures. And I was going to say also with Jan de Bont, I seem to remember reading that he really pushed strongly for the bus scenes to be shot practically, whereas maybe there was at some stage a push to have them blue screen. And I suppose that his cinematography background sort of led him to think that you would get better shots out of that.
Well, we have to discuss the elephant in the room, the bus jump. So let's go straight to it, because obviously everything to do with speed from the poster down ends up with the bus jump, although the poster did have it coming out of a fireball, which I always thought was interesting. So, Ron, when did you get involved on the sequence?
We were bidding the show from the outset. So it was to take a step even further back. I remember reading the script prior to having any idea about it, and it's actually something I've carried with me since then, because it's an excellent kind of point. You know, you talk about not being able to judge a book by its cover. I remember reading that script and just being really underwhelmed by everything in it, just thinking, you know, there's nothing in this movie. Nothing happens. It's just sort of, you know, a real simple linear. I don't know. I mean, clearly I was a naive reader at some point, but I really think it's amazing to me, kind of thinking that this, and going into this movie too, this is another kind of lesson for people that work on these films, is you never know what the movie's going to be when you start working on it. And I know that when we started working on this, and it was kind of like, oh, all right, sure, you know, this should be a quick and easy one. We can bang it out. It's not going to be too bad. And we can get onto something cooler when it's done. And, you know, it turned into one of the biggest movies of my career in terms of getting recognition. So it was definitely an abject lesson to me, in sort of not trying to guess what's going to happen with a movie just by looking at it at the outset.
So we're glad they didn't hire you for your script editing capabilities.
apparently so, yeah. Just to answer your question, yeah, we started off from the very beginning kind of bidding the shots, and we were involved. ImageWorks was involved with the model work as well as the CG work, so we can get into that too.
I was going to say, Ian, when was Ron making this film?
Well, I assume it's 1993, and 1994. This movie came out on June 10, 1994 in the States. Around the same time as True Lies, actually, or perhaps just after or just before. And I mean, we did a True Lies VFX show a couple of weeks ago, and it's interesting. It's the same sort of period and, you know, sort of a similar sort of feel to the film in some ways, I think.
Actually, Ron, it was on that show, I think, in the post-show discussion that Ian convinced me that we had to do a VFX show on the film Speed, because I was talking about that period of filmmaking, which I think was really interesting, where it wasn't a given that you would do something digitally, but by the same token, digital was just starting to become a real force to be reckoned with. So when you got at the script to the point of it actually being approved and you were on the film, were there a lot of discussions as to approach? Was it really felt that there were different options, different ways you could go, or was it always going to be a bus jump with some additional digital work to sell it?
I don't really remember for sure. Boyd Shermus was the primary visual effects supervisor on this, and so he was the one that would have been making those decisions. Because I remember reading the script from the outset, and none of the stuff had been shot yet, but I don't really, we're not involved at that level of some of the discussions. And again, you know, for me, this was my sort of first kind of supervisory role, and it wasn't, Like, I didn't know I was going to get a CG supervisor credit at the outset. It was just sort of, you know, it was available at the time and was sort of put on the show kind of from the beginning to sort of suss things out. And it eventually turned into a bigger show and more people were added to it. And I ended up being supervising the team.
Well, I mean, your point's well made. When it started out, it wasn't a blockbuster. When it started out, none of the... I mean, Keanu Reeves had done other important things. He was already a star before this film, but Sandra Bullock wasn't really. And certainly this film didn't have, going into it, any attached, I don't know, comic book, TV show, or something that was going to guarantee it to be a hit. In fact, the film almost didn't have enough money to get finished, and it was the positive reaction of test screenings that really pushed the studio to go further. So from your point of view, you were the CG supervisor. Just explain your role on... Let's go to the bus sequence. I think we need to discuss it in a little bit of depth. You know, what did you do on the bus sequence? And
so there's kind of two components to the bus sequence, some of which we did and some of which we ended up farming out. It was... I mean, I really think there was probably only maybe six shots that made up the bus sequence, you know, six actual visual effects shots. Something in that neighborhood, and it ended up being a combination of work that we did with some matte painting work done in-house, and then we ended up farming a piece of it out to I think they were VIFX at the time, one of those companies that's gone through a lot of name changes and eventually merged with Rhythm and Hues, but Richard Hollander supervising that, and the shots that we did farm out were in fact the ones that were shot handheld, because we didn't have any Flames in-house at the Flames or Infernos in-house at ImageWorks at the time, and it was clearly going to be something that required you know, the best sort of tracking solution, which was Flame at the time, and tracking, you know, 3D tracking kind of stuff where you could do this real iterative sort of approach to it. So those shots, which I think there was probably, if I remember right, and I could be way off, but if I remember, there was about three or four shots that were sent out to VIFX that were sort of the real handheld bus jumping shots, mostly like looking through the window of the, from the inside of the bus looking out. So it was just very bouncy and stuff. And then we did the ones that were shot locked off on VistaVision cameras, and then we added a post-production move on it. So that was kind of the breakdown of it, at least.
Interestingly, after this, Sony would go on to put an entire section of Flames and Infernos in it and call it high-speed compositing. And Sony Pictures ImageWorks would have a whole division just devoted to that kind of stuff. So I'm not going to Ian to run through it. Before I do that, Ron, were you on set when they shot this? Wasn't common.
For the bus jump? No.
Yeah, it wasn't common. So I'm going to get Ian. Can you just run through actually what happened on the bus jump, like just for those that don't know, just to give us the sort of facts of how it was put together?
Sure. Well, as the bus is approaching on the highway, the freeway obviously has a gap in it. And I think one of the first visual effects shots you see is this long zoom from the point of view of where the bus starts all the way up to the gap. And at the time, the gap didn't exist. So actually, that's a long tracking shot with the gap in put in and also some sort of scaffolding. So I'm interested about that shot too. But then once it gets up to the gap in the freeway, which didn't exist, they obviously shot a bus leaping, you know, a ramp. And then what they've done is they've inserted the gap, added in, you know, some sort of metalwork and things like that that would be missing from the freeway that's not been built. And then, you know, you get that sort of post move as the bus jumps over and sort of lands on the other side of the freeway.
Actually, right down to that landing shot, there are visual effects required, because I actually love the landing shot where it just seems to make it, where, of course, it completely was never in any danger. Mm-hmm. So, Ron, the biggest problem with this, from my point of view, is the bus goes up and it has to go up because it has to go up a ramp. Otherwise, just everyone, you know, who's ever had a childhood toy car and pushed it off a table knows that gravity kicks in pretty much straight away when there's no freeway to support you. And yet in the film, audiences bought it. I mean, there's no question about it. There'll be Mythbuster episodes in years to come where people will try and recreate it. There'll be countless forums where people bitch and gripe. But audiences loved it and audiences bought it. Was there any point at which you thought this idea of the bus going up was going to be a really impossible sell because, of course, it needs to look like it's going straight out?
Not really. Just because we'd already sort of seen the cut on it, so we kind of understood that that wasn't going to be too bad. I mean, it's definitely off because the bus seems to be going up, but it's going up a ramp that they built, so the road configuration looks okay on the individual shot. If you look at the wide shot, it's not really consistent, but on the shot itself where the bus kind of leaves the edge of the ramp, and that ramp itself was only, you know, probably 2-3 feet high, I think. But, you know, when it leaves that ramp, it looks like it's kind of going uphill a little bit. So you can buy it a little bit more just because of that. And we did have a lot of discussions about how, you know, how perilous to make it look and then where to cut the edge of the real world off and insert the matte painting. And Jan was very much about make it as barely making it as possible kind of thing. So, you know, you insert the matte painting right to the bus, you know, you find out where the bus wheel is and put the matte painting right there. And just make it fit.
Ian, do you want to comment on that height of that ramp? Or shall I?
I'm not sure, but don't forget, Mike, that Keanu says about, you know, a minute before, it's an interchange, there might be an incline.
Yeah. Okay, so, no, good.
There you go. See?
Plot recovery. I'm going to jump in then and say I've actually watched the making of footage of this more recently, Ron. I'll tell you, it's almost a bus height, that ramp, not 2 or 3 feet.
Yeah, you know what I was saying that? I was thinking, yeah, that's probably not right. Well, the funny thing is that's actually a case study that I did in my book, too. So the image is in my book, the before and after of that shot. It was even in the first edition of my book. So, yeah.
By the way, and by no means I know you intend this, but I will actually say the second edition of your book is particularly good. And for those that that haven't got it, I really enjoyed the often a second edition of a book is really just a minor update, but that was a cracker of a redo that you did on that book.
It's weighty, large.
No, it's good, and the case studies are particularly good. But yeah, it actually is testament to the fact that even you kind of remember it as me not being as big as it actually was. I will also say, and I give you this completely by way of credit. I watched the bus jump shot from obviously a witness camera of a, back then I guess would have been a VHS or something that somebody had. It just didn't look that exciting without the visual effects. It kind of looked a little lame. If I'd been standing on set, I would have been gulping going, how are we going to make this the feature that sells the film?
Well, I think that's probably why I remember it as not being that high of a ramp too, is because when you saw the thing go, when you saw the raw footage of it, you know, it sort of drives off the edge and you're, I mean, probably really they were kind of lucky that the front end of it didn't just dive straight down and it sort of crashed front end before the back end even got off.
So. Well, I think that's exactly what did happen to the first bus that jumped 2 days before, right? Because they did the whole jump and it failed and they didn't tell the studio and then did it again for the one that you guys got. So, and there was a guy actually, well, you want to go into the scene? There was actually a guy driving the darn thing.
Yeah, he was. He was strapped into the sort of, not right at the front of the bus, but just sort of halfway down and strapped in with bungee cords. And actually, if you watch the making of footage on the DVD, he forgot to put his mouth guard in, and he seems to have bit off part of his tongue in the landing, which I think is really interesting. I wanted to say also, I think, you know, the visual effects in that shot are amazing, but what also works is the editing. You know, you get a lot of different angles at the bus.
Yeah.
The sound effects editing too, there's a bit of a soaring sound, and I think, you know, I mean, you know it can't make it, but everything comes together for that shot to make it feel like the
bus. And the score, right? If I remember correctly, the score is just terrific at that point. We should just credit, I think Brown was the name of the stuntman, and he did do a good job because if I'd met him and they'd crashed 1-2 days before and it had wiped out, I wouldn't have been so enthusiastic to attempt it. But yeah, you're right. I think the audio really, really helped a lot. But look, nothing helped more, Ron, than the flock of birds for the gap. Now, talk to me about those.
Well, you know, that's sort of the classic trick that I don't, you know, I'm sure it wasn't originated with this, but it was one of those things where you've got a matte painting and it's obviously pretty dead, and you got to figure out what to put in there to kind of give it some life, even if there's not necessarily something moving. And so you know, you have to come up with something to add to the scene. And that was also added by the guys at VIFX, and they had just done some other thing that had a flocking behavior. It might have even been a SIGGRAPH paper or a SIGGRAPH short piece or something that was you know, flocking behavior test, and so they applied that to these birds that they put in so that they moved the way a flock of birds would when it's startled. And it's just the little tricks like that, you know, anytime you got a matte painting, you toss some cloud movement or smoke coming off of chimneys in the distance or whatever it is to kind of take the curse off of what is otherwise a fairly flat piece of artwork. And so this was just a classic example of that, that you know, once you start sort of knowing that or looking for shots that are matte paintings or are synthetic, you probably tend to see more than your average number of birds in those shots.
And it's always a suitable flock, you know, forming yes. and bunching and flocking as they do.
Yep.
So my shot, as I said, I like the most in that sequence is the landing shot. It's the shot of the concrete that is just clear of where the wheels touch down at the back. You mentioned it a moment ago. And I guess for me, was that a matte painting? Was it a photograph of some concrete you just comped in? How'd you do that?
No, it was almost entirely a matte painting. A guy named Dave Douglas, who was our first matte painter we hired at ImageWorks, really, really talented guy. I learned a lot from him. He was actually younger than me, but he had just grown up, you know, living and breathing and eating and everything matte painting stuff, and so he was really a student of the art form. And when he started painting this, you know, I sat with him a lot, just sort of seeing what he was doing. And yeah, you know, he had a lot of reference footage, but he ended up really painting almost all of that from scratch. And he was one of the first matte painters too to be working in a digital fashion on this too. But yeah, you know, just the one thing I remember from that I really explicitly remember learning. You know, a lot of times as we're figuring out our careers and visual effects stuff, you know, kind of don't really remember when you learn certain concepts. But I really, for some reason, remember that when the bus actually leaves the ramp. You know, the shadow of the bus has to kind of curve around and down. So we had to add in a new shadow, right, that runs across mm-hmm. the front of the face of this empty or unfinished concrete face with all the rebar and everything sticking out. And my first reaction, because I comped the shot with the matte painting, my first reaction was to just dim it down, you know, just put a brightness on there. And it was actually Dave Douglas, the matte painter, was like, oh, no, I need to give you another matte painting to mix in because you can't just darken it. I need to take all the highlights out of it because that's what a shadow would do, is all those hot highlights come out. And, you know, in retrospect, it's like, well, yeah, of course. But at the time, it had just never even occurred to me. And so that, you know, that whole section is not just a shadow based on, you know, brightness 0.7. It's a whole new matte painting that's revealed that is a different light. You know, not only do the highlights have to come out, but the existing shadows had to be removed because you didn't want just darker shadows because you were hiding a light source.
Yeah, you need to match shadows to shadows that were there. You need to obviously match black levels, but you're absolutely right. If you are bringing down, you have effectively a contrast range between the highlights and the darks, which gets compressed a bit, but in no way matches what would be otherwise a relatively flat contrast from a primary source being hidden as the way the sun would do. It's a very, very
exactly.
good point.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going from something that is a very strong point light source, i.e. the sun, to what is something that's really only illuminated by ambient light, you know, reflections off of everything else in the world.
So can you just talk to us about what tools you did have? You said that you were pre-Flame at Sony at this point. Like, what was the sort of tools of the trade circa Sony around this time?
For all this stuff, it was comped using Wavefront's Composer tool. Which started off life as a product called Video Composer, and then at some point they realized that, you know, people were using it on film. As a marketing point of view, they realized they should just call it Composer. But it was sort of it was not a node based compositor. It was sort of this stack layer based thing, and, you know, very crude by today's standards, but it had all the basic functionality in it that you needed. I put a lot of shots through that, and it was sort of, you know, one of the first off-the-shelf compositing tools that was out there. Beyond that, I don't really remember. I mean, I don't think there was any 3D in this. I think David painted the map painting in another obsolete piece of software called Matador. And even the smoke and stuff for the dust that's kicked up at the landing, I think that was all sort of hand-animated stuff in a 2D fashion.
What was the bit depth and just like the run of things sort of around this time? Were you...
Boy.
Because there were a whole bunch of films, and I know Speed was one of them, that were actually 8-bit composites, especially when in the early days, I think Terminal Velocity and that kind of era. And then we went to using 10-bit log format, but it was, you know, generally speaking, they were big files back then.
Boy, I don't remember if Composer was 16-bit or 8-bit at that point or not.
Before OpenEXRs and multipass pipelines.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, floating point was not even worthy of discussion. It was just crazy to even think that a computer could handle that level of data. So it could easily have been 8-bit kind of comping stuff. It was so... Everything about converting film over to a digital format and understanding the sitting on file format was so much of a mystery still to so many of us in the field. And, you know, we were kind of, I mean, I honestly think that Kodak intentionally kind of wrote somewhat obscure documentation for the Cineon file format. I really do think they were selling a hardware solution.
I was
going to
say they were selling Cineon back then, an actual compositing platform.
Absolutely. And so I don't think they had a whole lot of incentive to make the file format particularly decipherable.
Though, as credit to the engineers of Kodak, I mean, that file format still inside a DPX wrapper is what is used on so many productions today.
Oh, and it's smartly done. I mean, it's very much designed to take advantage of the fact that you don't have a huge amount of bit depth, but, you know, the whole logarithmic file format, the packing of 3 channels, 10 bits each into a 32-bit word or 30 bits with a couple extras left over so that you could be very efficient. I mean, so much of what that Cineon file format is was you can trace directly back to the hardware they built to go with it, and all the rest of us that weren't using that hardware were effectively kind of trying to reverse engineer it and then extract something, and it was a lot of it was really done in the vacuum, and it was just sort of, it seems like it looks okay.
I think one of the really interesting things back then was, and we take this for granted today, but today a pipeline would have us deal with files quite often with a viewing LUT so that we wouldn't affect the underlying file, and we would be able to composite and do our work with effectively a pair of viewing glasses on, though. Obviously, what I mean by that is a 3D LUT on the monitor. Back then, you used to have to transcode files a lot. You used to convert files into a format that you could work in and then try and convert it back. And in the process, one of the big concerns was that a visual effects shot would actually sit seamlessly with what was on either side of it. Because unlike today, your film speed would not have had a DI, would it?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you know, you were basically trying to get a digital file that would then go back to film, that would then go to some color timer, you know, back in the days before you had any kind of digital intermediate, and this guy would try and get the stuff that you had put out to match everything you'd cut, you know, had been cut around it, and it often didn't quite work. And, you know, a lot of times what would happen is...
So you're going to have to... Sorry, Ron, because we're talking to a generation that isn't yours and mine, including Ian, you have to explain what a color timer is.
Yeah, yes. Back in the day.
Yes. No, but seriously, like a film color timer was not sitting there with a bunch of knobs on a workstation. They were literally adjusting points in the film printer.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they had 3 knobs, I guess, or 3 sort of dials that they would use to kind of dial in color filters that helped them understand what they needed to use, which would then get sent back to the lab where the photochemical equivalent of all this was done. You know, it was very crude, and it was really, really just, you know, effectively 3 basic color correctors, you know, how much red, green, and blue you were putting into it.
And what's really significant about that is there was absolutely no concept of being able to set black levels or adjust contrast or even saturation the way we think of it now as being the most basic functions. So I imagine, as was the case with every visual effects house back then, you would have had dailies where you would literally have been projecting film of your comps to try and work out whether or not they actually matched in terms of black levels and gray to things either side of them. Because if you didn't get it, no one else could have would.
Yeah, it's not something that you could do in a final color timing step or a DI kind of step. You had to get it right. And, you know, a lot of times if you didn't get it right, what the colorist would end up doing is they would have to make a decision, you know, is most of this shot synthetic, and should I make that part match as much as possible, or is most of it, you know, the original plate, and should I adjust that? But then the CG might not look good, so it all seems very Stone Age at the time.
Now, Ian, I will come back to you in a second. I just want to finish this one point, though, with Ron, and I think the last point I want to make on that, Ron, is that this, I think you mentioned it earlier, a bunch of this stuff was shot in VistaVision, and the reason we used to do that back in the day was... One of the other issues was grain management, because, of course, you had no grain management tools of a digital sense in terms of integrating grain profiles, and not having a visual effect shot suddenly look grainier and more processed than the intercut close-ups beside it was also another big giveaway we used to have to worry about.
Yeah, because, you know, visual effects shots would go through an extra generation, right? They would be scanned in and then put back out to a negative, and then that would, you know, prints would be struck from that. So you've got an extra kind of step in all of there. So yeah, if you shot a larger format negative like VistaVision, it gave you a couple things. It gave you, you know, much bigger negative so that you could average the grain together, but it also gave you that much bigger negative so that you could do a post process move, camera move on it, which was done for all of these shots, I think, as well.
So I'm going to change tack now and jump back to you, if I can, Ian, because we've focused on the bus sequence. And I've got to say, that is, you know, to most people, you say the word speed in reference to this film, and that's what they're going to think of. But there are actually some other really great action sequences and effect sequences in this, from the early elevator stuff through to the end train stuff, which, of course, a lot of people even forget there was a train sequence. What did you think of the other sequences, Ian, in the film?
Yeah, you're right. The elevator sequence at the beginning is so great because, you know, it's using a lot of miniature elevators or insides of elevators that they constructed. And then in that sequence, when they're trying to rescue the passengers, of course, they use a crane to try and make sure they don't fall down. And eventually that crane can't hold them up and it falls down the elevator shaft. And I assume that that crane's completely digital. And so it's a really nice sequence where the crane gets pulled down and sort of follows the elevator down. And, you know, that's sort of a miniature elevator and you've got this digital crane following, which I really love that sequence when it sort of slightly touches the side of the elevator shaft and there's a few sparks and, you know, it cuts in again with the guys sort of watching and the people on the ground as it slams into the ground. So, you know, again, it's not really just the visual effects. It's sort of everything about the editing and the sound.
Actually, it's funny you said that because the thing about that sequence that really set it for me was what happened outside. The editing of the car pulling up and this kind of 360-degree move around the car, the energy that was provided by the arriving at that scene before they went in, spoke volumes, I think, to the cinematography heritage of the director, but also just the editor, as you pointed out. Ron, how was that elevator scene done with the crane? Was it digital?
Yeah, so the elevator shaft itself was a miniature, big long miniature. It was built on its side because we didn't really care that it was, you know, we didn't need to build something really tall. We just needed something that you could move a camera all the way down. It's interesting, too, to note that that elevator, if you look at the title credits, that's also shot in that elevator miniature where, you know, it's the, yep, the, you know, all the titles and everything are sort of revealed by it. But, yeah, so the elevator shaft was a practical miniature element. And then, yes, the crane was a CG 3D element. It was really, you know, that was back whenever ImageWorks had not done a whole lot of 3D stuff. And ImageWorks, as a startup visual effects company, had done mostly compositing 2D kind of stuff. And I'm trying to remember, you know, how much other 3D work we'd done at the time, but it hadn't been a whole lot.
It's so hard to imagine that, knowing the amazing 3D work that Sony does these days. It's just almost hard to imagine at a time.
Yeah, but, you know, it's because it was a, you know, really small startup. And even when we were doing this shot, I don't think ImageWorks was certainly less than 100 people at that point. Hadn't done a whole lot of really, you know, photorealistic 3D kind of stuff. And this was one of the first shots that we did using RenderMan as well, because we really needed that high-quality motion blur that RenderMan had. This crane is obviously moving quickly as it falls down the elevator shaft. So, yeah, it was a nice combination of things. And I was a little bit worried about it because it was doing stuff that we hadn't really done before, which seems incredibly simple by today's standard. But at the time, I remember, you know, wondering if we were going to be able to pull it off and get it to look real or not.
And one of the other things I loved in this was after that sequence, which was terrific, and it was just a great setup for the film. But you had this second setup with the explosion down. Well, I know it was filmed in Santa Monica because I know the intersection really well because I've had coffee from the firehouse down there many times with our FX guide co-founder Jeff Huser. But the bus blowing up from the cafe that is the signal that, of course, the bomber isn't dead, and this is kicks off the bus sequence. Do you remember what it was like? Because I think it was a little unexpected. I remember sort of being surprised at such a sort of sudden turnaround when I watched the film for the first time. Can you remember your reaction?
Oh, absolutely. And isn't that shot great that it sort of follows Keanu as he's going back to his car, and then, you know, in the background, that's where the explosion is. And I suppose that characterizes a lot of the shots in Speed. They're not, they're sort of really well framed, and you know, I guess that comes back to Jan de Bont. But particularly that explosion, yeah, definitely surprising, and it sort of changes the course of the film, doesn't it? I'd like to talk about the explosions as well. You know, it seems to me that most of those, if not all of them, were completely practical. You know, from that one to obviously when the bus finally blows up at the airport.
the plane, you mean? The $80,000 plane they blew up in the Mojave Desert.
Absolutely. And, you know.
I just want to send out a runner. If you could just go get us a plane. Yeah, we won't be returning it. No, it won't be a hire. Yeah. And maybe some dump trucks. That'd be great. And here's a check for 80 grand.
I just think if that film was shot now, you know, it probably wouldn't. They wouldn't look to practical explosions. And, you know, you only need to look at, and dare I mention it, Speed 2, which didn't always use practical explosions and I don't think to nearly as good effect.
Now, Ron, you didn't work on Speed 2, did you?
No, I did that. Good, in fact, you. I haven't even seen Speed 2. So.
Okay, good. Thank you. So obviously they were realistic explosions, but back in the day, if you had been asked to do an explosion like that digitally, I think the bill... I'm not asking for insider numbers, but I think the bill from Sony would have been more than $80,000 to try and pull off a shot like that.
I don't think we would have done. I mean, I think we would have just told them we couldn't do it. You know, I know we would have said that. I think we would have been like, that's just not in anywhere in our wheel well at this point of something that we could do in any kind of cost-effective fashion. You know, effectively, at that point, you would have been asking the production to fund an R&D effort to figure out how to do it. And I don't think this was at that level.
Now, I assume the bus was actually blown up rather than it being a miniature that was comped in.
Yeah, as far as I remember, there were no shots relating to the bus running into that or any of those explosion things. The only shots that we ended up doing was sort of in the subway stuff later.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the scaling of explosions and water back then meant that you had to have quite a large... obviously, you could slow it down, but you have quite a large effect in the first place. You couldn't do a 20-to-1 scale on an explosion. You could do like a 4-to-1. And so it would have been complex and quite expensive anyway to have built a bus. But you did, as you say, have to go and do that for the end sequence, the sequence with the train. So let's discuss that. I'm going to get Ian, if you can critique it first, just to walk us through what happened at the end of the film and how successful you thought it was on screen.
Right. So... you know, Dennis Hopper has taken Sandra Bullock away and Keanu's after them on the subway in downtown LA. And in terms of visual effects in that sequence, it starts off actually with a fight between Dennis Hopper and Keanu on the roof of the train. And, you know, I think that was actually shot with a rear projection, which still looks, you know, it still looks really good. And then once Keanu's disposed of Dennis Hopper... he loses his head, actually. then Keanu and Sandra can't actually get off the train, so they end up speeding it up and, you know, braking the train at one point as it's going through a sort of underground construction area. And eventually it comes out onto the surface at near the Chinese Theater, I think. And, you know, that train was a miniature that was shot and... yeah, I think it looks really good. You know, there's probably some points at which the train, you know, looks a bit small and sort of doesn't have some interactive lighting and lights on inside. But, you know, apart from that, I think it works really well.
Yeah, I liked it. I think I was a little concerned that they jumped the shark in terms of just how many kind of weird and wonderful things are going on. And also, I don't even know if the subway was open. I mean, it wasn't even like there is a subway. There's like a light rail. But I mean, every film from The Italian Job through, if there's any chance of having a subway in LA, let's blow it up, smash it, drop armored trucks into it, whatever. But if you leave out the plot side of that, Ron, how did it come about in terms of visual effects?
Yeah, the stuff underneath in the subway itself was a good sized miniature subway train and subway setup. It was a lot of fun. You know, it was the biggest sort of miniature set I'd ever been on up to that point. And some guys called Sesame's Engineering. I don't know that they're still around, but they sort of were kind of experts in doing trains and that sort of thing, train miniatures. And so they put together this very detailed, I mean, it was just fun to see it, you know, very detailed set of subway cars and the whole subway system as well. And what we ended up doing was kind of putting those together. Some of those pieces were shot separately and they needed to be put together. And, you know, there's people on the tracks in a practical set that have to run to get out of the way before the comped in train, you know, just barely misses them, that kind of thing. So it was a lot of fun. I remember, again, you know, talking about kind of getting some life into the scene. I remember that a lot of stuff we added was just sparks and smoke and everything. It was the crew t-shirt for the practical thing. I had a quote from Jan, and it just had right across the front of the t-shirt was, "I need more sparks." And it said with Jan's, you know, typical Dutch accent, "More sparks. I think we need more sparks."
So tell me, have I missed out a huge section of visual effects, or was there, what was the, you know, the primary work that you guys were doing? Because we've obviously discussed the jump of the bus, but
That's really all I remember. That's what I said. When, you know, it was not a huge show. There were not that many shots in it. People remember the shots because they were so integral and just so action-packed. But I think it's an excellent lesson in sort of smart filmmaking and getting something that feels like it was, you know, really involved in everything when you think back on it. But really, if I had to guess what the shot count on this was, it's way less than 100, and I would be not at all surprised to feel it, you know, find out it's only about maybe 30 or so digital shots in there.
You know, the thing that really appeals to me about this film, the fact that there were 11 buses used and that they cut them and filmed them and that out the window wasn't all green screen. This film, I think, would have been disastrous had we just not bought the fact that they were in a real bus moving along a real road. Even though, yeah, okay, the 50-mile-an-hour thing comes back to haunt you in a realistic analysis. But nevertheless, in any individual shot, it doesn't feel like a bad comp. It feels like what it was, which was very clever filmmaking. Wouldn't you agree, Ron?
Yeah, well, I've always sort of been a big fan of not a fan of using green screen, I guess, a big fan of trying to avoid it as much as possible. The only green screen or blue screen that I even remember was in the elevator shaft at the beginning. Keanu is comped into the scene. He was sort of standing on I think it was a blue screen, and he was put into the shot. But I don't even remember any other blue screen or green screen in the movie. And I think that's, I mean, especially back then where it was so hard to control the lighting and everything when you were shooting blue screen and getting an accurate match to the set, that I think it was definitely the way to go because you had natural lighting wherever it was possible.
I don't know if this is true or not, but apparently, according to our research from, as I say, our producer Todd, who does great stuff for the program, the director actually came up with that elevator sequence while filming Die Hard because he literally got stuck in an elevator and had to climb out of the escape hatch, which I just thought was a great anecdote. I hope it's true. And in terms of the end sequence, but the near end sequence with the plane blowing up, I did want to ask you, because they obviously couldn't blow up an airplane at LAX, was there any digital work in selling the Mojave Desert airplane explosion into the Los Angeles? Because normally you would think, well, that's going to be a lot of compositing to get that sequence to look like it's all taking place at LAX.
Yeah, maybe Ian can correct me if based on information on the DVD or something, but I don't remember any visual effects in that sequence at all. There's nothing that we worked on.
No, there's no digital work there. And in fact, if you watch it, you can see the mountains of the Mojave in the background.
LA has mountains. They just have a Hollywood sign on it.
Well, or we have mountains, but you only see them a few days of the year when the smog clears.
Yeah,
but of course you're not looking at them, are you? You're looking at the plane, so you know it still it works.
Yeah, I should point out, Ron, that when I say Ian would know this, he's not likely to know it just from having watched a DVD extra. I think he actually has a collection of memorabilia from your film. Is that right, Ian?
Sadly, that's true. I've got about 80 posters from around the world that came out when the film came out, and lots of memorabilia. So if anyone's actually got any, just...
What's your prized possession from... and you're not allowed to have Ron, but what's your prized possession from the film?
Well, there's actually this amazing graphic novel from Japan where someone has re-illustrated the entire film as a comic, you know, as a graphic novel. And it was released in Japan. You know, I've got one of two copies, apparently. So, you know, it's great. It's all in Japanese.
So the guy only made two copies of the thing, or?
Well, apparently there's only two left, two around.
Okay.
So, yeah, might be wrong about that. People might call me up, but
you actually had an exhibition of Speed stuff once, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Wow.
Just a bunch of my posters and dolls and various things.
You mean action figures? You don't mean dolls?
Action
right?
figures. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I can go for an action figure on a cubicle wall. A doll is like starting to get a bit worrying.
So, Ian, this is probably going to make you ill, but if I believe that at some point in the last couple of years, I cleaned out some of my old files, and I think I had some of the Wedge tests we shot for color, and I don't know that I still have them around. They may have been trashed, but had I known that you were such a fan, I probably could have sent them to you.
Oh, dear.
Well, plus you threw out that whole bus that you had in your backyard, right?
Yeah, exactly. Having said that, I will go back and check my files and see if I kept any of that, kept any of those original things, because that was. Oh, I mean, it's actually interesting to mention that, because going back to talking about color timing, that's the other thing that you sort of characterized as we'd sit in a room trying to figure out how to match colors, but there was this whole concept of what we called wedges.
Yep, wedges.
Isn't really done anymore, right? Because you have such.
Fidelity, and also you have just such faith in the 3D LUTs and the calibration systems. But calibration systems and all that stuff was in its early days.
Yeah,
back then.
So for those that aren't familiar with what a wedge is, I mean, it's literally you would film something out with just a variety of different mixing and matching different parameters with the hopes that you sort of randomly got one that would look the way it should when it was all said and done. So, you would typically film out something that was a couple points brighter in green and a couple points brighter in blue, or, up and down in the color spectrum, and then also on the digital side, sort of increasing and decreasing contrast or saturation a little bit, because it was so hit and miss. And so you would try all these different combinations.
And then write down all the numbers. And then if the director said, I like number 8, you'd look up what number 8 had been and then hope
and
that...
Once you got all this stuff back from the lab and it was developed and printed, then you would sit in front of a light box with a loop, and your effects supervisor and the director would look at these sort of things and try to and generally look at the piece of cut footage from a print of somewhere else, nearby in that sequence, and just try to see which ones matched. And there was none of this matching it accurately in a well-controlled situation. It was literally you throw out a bunch of random variations on what you thought was about as close as you could get, and then you pick the one that felt right.
Now, just to be clear about this, what Ron's talking about, and I did this myself, the same thing, is not putting them up on the screen and comparing them, you understand. It's getting a light box with the right color temperature and then even enough proper light in the light box, putting bits of actual film on it, and then holding a little magnifying thing about 3 inches tall on top of that, and staring it, then looking up at the monitor, then staring back at the thing and trying to compare and contrast. This was talk about developing your eye. This was really hardcore, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, and it was very much about there was the whole who's the best at kind of picking these colors off of these things and understanding the color matching and all that.
Well, if you have the wedges, please FedEx them to Ian if he's still breathing. And if you need to get them scanned, I'll happily help out with some friends with some telecities. So it's actually quite fun just looking at the wedges. The other thing about that, of course, is we sort of joke about it, but these were not stupid decisions. It just we hadn't really developed the science of how to do everything quite right, and there were so many things that had to fall into place, right down, Ron, to just the labs consistently working the same way and not getting different results on different days.
That is sort of the big lie to this idea of trying to match all these colors, is that you'd be so careful about dialing in something and picking the one you liked, and then you'd run another batch out of the lab with the exact same settings and it would be completely different, far more variation than any of the sort of really fine numbers that you were trying to adjust. So it was a crapshoot.
So was there any final aspects about the film that maybe didn't make it into the film, or anything about that you wanted to touch on, Ron, before we wind up?
I don't remember anything that was cut out of it. I mean, for me, the other huge deal that Speed was, it was nominated for a British Academy Award. And I was one of the four nominees on that, which surprised me. And I think that, too, kind of goes back to this sense of there were no expectations on this film. which is why a fairly junior guy like me ended up supervising it. You know, had any of the more senior supervisors at the facility sort of known that this film was going to get recognized?
Yeah, huge blockbuster.
Absolutely. I can guarantee you that they would, when, you know, one of them would have said, yeah, no, I'm going to be supervising that. But because it was sort of, it had no expectations, you know, it was kind of tossed to me as the one of the junior guys in there. And I'm sure everybody was like, God, I can't believe I let that Brinkman guy on this when I could have had my name on it. So
now, what year did we say that it came out in? 93, was it? Or 94?
94. June 94.
And so what was up for the Oscar in visual effects in 94? Do you remember what it would have been up for to get in the...
I remember very well, because as we were talking and I was trying to see if I had anything left for Ian there, I pulled out the little file I had, one of the files. I haven't found anything yet for you, Ian, but I do have the the Bake Off page that we had. And so the seven films in the Bake Off were Speed, The Mask, True Lies, The Lion King, Forrest Gump, Interview with the Vampire, and The Hudsucker Proxy.
And of course, it was what, Mask and Forrest Gump and True Lies that went through to be the three from that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well, and that, so those were the three in the for the regular Academy. So I wasn't nominated for that, although I did have the fun of standing up in front of everybody at the Bake Off.
The Bake Off was fun back then. You actually could show making of stuff back then, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think we did show. But then the nice thing about the British Academy is they actually had four nominees instead of three. So I managed to, Speed managed to squeak in as the fourth nominee that year, which is how we got nominated.
So were True Lies, Forrest Gump, and Mask the other three in the British Academy Awards?
I don't remember for sure, because you know a lot of these movies wouldn't always be released in the same year in the UK as they were over here.
And I should just point out that being in the Bake Off is a great honor for the industry, but you're also up against what? That was those films, the ones we just mentioned, that would have been like Scott Squires, Ken Ralston... Yep. John Bruno was on True Lies. Was True Lies, right?
John Bruno was True Lies. Ken was on. I was on Forrest Gump.
Gump, yeah. I'm sure it was Scott Squires.
Mask was Scott Squires. Yep.
Yep.
And so I mean, it was clear. I had no expectation that it was going
to
be.
And I've got to say that Forrest Gump, as much as I love Speed, Forrest Gump also had some very good visual effects in it.
Yeah, and clearly Forrest Gump was pushing the state of the art, whereas, you know, in most ways, Speed was extremely conventional in terms of what effects were done on it. They were, you know, I think they were done well, but a lot of that was just due to being shot very well, too. Whereas, you know, Forrest Gump was clearly taking things to the next generation, next level of effects.
Well, I think we'll have to add Forrest Gump into our roster of films that in a future episode we'll come back and look at for visual effects. Because, again, one of those films that, a bit like Speed, really, I think with hindsight you think of different things. If you watch a film again, for example, with Speed, I honestly think that most people think of it as being just the bus until you go, well, remember the elevator? Oh, yeah. Remember the train? Oh, yeah. Kind of, it's so prominent, the bus, that you kind of think the whole film was that. And I think with Forrest Gump as well, you tend to think of other things other than the great visual effects work that the team did. And of course, it won Best Picture, so it was, you know, rightly singled out for so many things. Ian, do you have any other questions for Ron before we finish up for this week?
Oh no, that's great. I was interested in the older versions of the software and things you were using, and you know whether you thought, you know, those had really moved on to something so much grander and better, or you know, were they were good for the time?
Yeah, well, they certainly were our only choice at the time. It was, you know, at the time, I mean, I was having fun using them. I generally, maybe because I was really had lived and breathed Composer quite a bit, I was pretty happy using it, and it was able to do most of what we needed. It grew long in the tooth pretty quick. But
what did you think of those rig projection shots in the on top of the train? Was there ever a point you were like, "Man, I wish we could have comped those"?
No, I actually, you know, again, just because of my kind of distaste for blue screens that don't work, I think in a lot of ways, a rear projection is a nice sort of thing because you get the lighting realistically in the scene.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, if you can match lighting, which of course is the same for green screen as it is for rear projection, so that it doesn't seem incongruous, then of course you can get really nice things and you avoid digital haircuts of people shrinking mats, which is always good.
Yep.
Ron, where are you at the moment? Because you've done a couple of interesting things in the last few years. Where are you? And I know that you have other podcasts, but where are you actually professionally working?
I am not. Yeah, no, I'm in the midst of starting up a few different things, none of which I can talk about, and kind of enjoying a little bit of time off between gigs. So,
is the best place for people to find you on the Twitters, or
probably on Twitter is typically your best bet for seeing me do much of anything online. And it's just Ron Brinkman, RONBRINKMANN, on Twitter. I do a blog, which is digitalcomposting.com. I have digitalcompositing.com, which is nicely hosted by Mike, and that tends to get more visual effects related discussions on there, specifically just stuff about my book. And then Digital Composting is my blog, where I can talk about completely random crap and, you know, a lot of my photography kind of stuff too.
I must say, I really do like your photography. I would like to see more of your just sort of straight photography work. I know that you are on This Week in Photography as a regular founding member, but that being said, it's easy to talk about the photography and not actually be looking at the photographs that you take, and you have a really nice eye, and some of your exterior stuff is just gorgeous.
Well, thank you. I mean, I tend to usually just shoot photos when I travel, so I guess the real trick is I need to travel more.
Yeah.
So if anybody out there wants to fly me someplace interesting, I'm happy to do that.
Excellent. And Ian, what about you?
Well, you can contact me at twitter.com/VFXblog, or check out my articles on FX Guide.
Now, Ron, we're going to be all heading over to SIDGRAPH. I know Ian's coming over. Are you going to be around in LA, or are you going to be up in Northern California?
No, I should be around, so hopefully we can get together and catch up.
Excellent. Well, if you do have any wedges, Ian will happily buy you, an entire holiday in Hawaii. But,
it's not looking good, Ian. I'm poking through files as we're recording here. I'm afraid it's not looking so good. So.
And I really would suggest you go over to Ron's blog and have a look at some of his exterior stuff. It really is like some of the – you must do a lot of hiking, right? Like you get to really very nice locations.
Yeah, that's kind of – what I do for fun is try to get someplace interesting and take pictures of it.
All right. Well, of course, I'm over at FX Guide or FX PhD. If you want to follow me, we have the VFX show hosted off FX Guide now, and I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour. I want to thank Matt, our producer, and Todd, our producer. These guys do an enormous amount of work behind the scenes. Matt normally does the editing work and Todd normally does the research work, but between the two of them, they put the show together. As we said a little while ago, we've been expanding the VFX show and doing new and interesting things, and we've been really pleased with the response we've got from you guys, so we want to thank you so much. Now, I would normally finish the show by giving a quote from the film in some kind of lame attempt at humor, but Ian, I think I'm going to have to defer to you for your favorite quote from the film to take us out. So I'll say goodbye. Ron, thank you very much. And
thank you. Great.
And Ian, a favorite quote from the film, perhaps?
I think I just like when Keanu says to Dennis Hopper, throwing the line back at him, "What do you do? What do you do?"
Until next time, see ya.